Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're bringing you an episode from The Vault. This one originally aired on June 23rd, 2022. And it is Rob's interview with Ryan Tucker Jones, author of a book called Red Leviathan, which has to do with whales. And I think we've been doing a lot of whales lately, so it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, and I've referred back to this book a couple of times as well, Red Leviathan, The Secret History of Soviet Whaling. So I thought it'd be a great time to just go ahead and feature this interview once more. I think it's a really informative one, and here we go.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb. My co-host Joe is on leave this week, so I have an interview for you. I recently talked with Ryan Jones of the University of Oregon. His new book is Red Leviathan, The Secret History of Soviet Whaling. So this is a fascinating book, and I think we had a fascinating chat about the history, specifically the 20th century history of whaling, and how that factors into Russian history, the history of the Soviet Union, but also global history as well. A word of caution that this interview will, of course, discuss whaling, which is going to have some graphic details in it. So be advised on that count. But on the other hand, I want to stress that this will not just be a parade of horrors. There's a lot of interesting historical and cultural information in here as well. So without further ado, let's go straight to the interview. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So your book concerns whaling, which humans have been engaging in for thousands of years, and yet 20th century whaling stands out in rather appalling ways. Can you set the scene for us regarding 20th century whaling and what truly sets it apart from the sort of 19th century whaling that many of us are probably familiar with from the likes of Moby Dick?
Yeah, that's right, Rob. I mean, 19th century whaling, which was dominated by the Americans, was a really low-tech enterprise that still managed to sweep nearly the entire Earth, Pacific, Indian, Atlantic Ocean, and had a pretty massive impact on certain whale species like sperm whales. Others, it left entirely untouched, especially the fast whales, the big whales that many people would be familiar with, humpback whales, blue whales, fin whales, etc., and major parts of the ocean that were just off limits to people working with sail technology, like the Antarctic, which is the place where the most whales used to live, at least. And so 20th century whaling was far less talked about. far less romanticized and written about. There is no Herman Melville for the 20th century industrial era, and yet it was by an order of magnitude more devastating for most whale species. Do you want me to talk a little bit about the technology? I'm mindful of not just going on and on with my answers and boring your readers.
No, I think we'd all love to have a little technological background. My next question, in fact, was going to be about the Stern slipway and what it was and why it was so essential to modern whaling.
Yeah, I mean, the technology, there was really a major change in the technological implementations of whaling at the end of the 19th century, mostly brought about by Norwegians. Who had been whaling in their nearshore waters, but perfected a few things like the exploding harpoon gun, which actually sent a grenade into a whale, exploded inside its body, which was far more lethal and far less lethal for humans because they could kill the whale often with one or two shots rather than having to tire it out over a long period of time being attached to this gigantic dangerous creatures they had in sail whaling. So that was one of the major changes that took place. The other was the Stern slipway, Rob, which you just mentioned. And this was a classical industrial piece of technology, which allowed whales to be winched on board the whale ship, which really fundamentally changed the whole industry. It meant that you didn't have to process whales either in the ocean on the side of the ship, as people did in Moby Dick, for example, or that you even had to go ashore and process whales at shore factories. What this meant was that you could stay out to sea with your mother ship, your factory ship, and just process whales day after day after day. They'd be brought to you by a fleet of catcher boats, taken to the mother ship, winched up at the Stern slipway, and then a whole army of industrial workers would process that whale carcass into the products that people in the 20th century wanted, which increasingly was margarine, butter substitute was another technological innovation, the process of hydrogenation, which allowed people, scientists, to inject hydrogen. I better not. Maybe I won't go so firmly into the details of hydrogenation, but it allowed them to process whale meat in such a way that it was basically stripped of any fishy flavor. People didn't even know they were eating margarine that had come from whales oftentimes. And this was the major driver behind 20th century global industrial whaling.
You also mentioned that this allowed for the processing of the carcass to take place out of sight, right? This would have made it a little more hidden.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, certainly not for those involved in it. For those involved in it, you would see just hundreds on some days, literally hundreds of whales being processed. But it allowed the industry really to take place, well, first of all, in the Antarctic. The Antarctic started being hunted in the 1910s based on this new technology and then really peaked in the 20s and 30s, so far away from where any humans lived that you'd get this product, this margarine, with really no sense of what kind of labor, what kind of danger, what kind of slaughter had produced it. Previously, whaling had always taken place pretty far from shore, but it had always been, pretty closely connected with shore industry as well, since you often processed the whales on shore, etc. Often hunted whales, in many cases that were not that far away from human populations. So, yeah, it really changed the industry in a lot of ways, making it, in some ways, far more mysterious for most people.
And you mentioned, too, that the 20th century whaling also, it impacted more species of whales as compared to the 19th century.
Yeah, whales, a lot of whales are really hard to catch without industrial technology. They're fast. They can stay underwater for a long period of time. And as with fishing, the 20th century just saw a series of innovations that allowed people to overcome The whale's ability to escape, first of all, diesel engines, of course, which are so much faster, allowed them to really run down any species they wanted to. Then sonar, after the Second World War, came into greater use. Airplanes, which allowed them to spot. You'd often on this mothership would have a helicopter or an airplane, but usually a helicopter pad where helicopters would take off and search the area for whales, tell people where the large agglomerations were. Then they could chase them down with these really fast ships and then process them on board. I mean, you know, for whales, you can only imagine this was a, you know, obviously devastating suite of technologies. They never faced predators like this on this scale or with this lethality. They were really totally unprepared, especially the big ones like blue whales and fin whales, you know, the two largest species on Earth, which really sustained the whaling industry from the 1910s through the 1960s.
Yeah, in terms of what it was like for the whales, you described this as the breaking of their quote, cultures and families. Can you describe that a little bit for us?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. This is one of the things I wanted to do with the book was to, you know, I mean, the statistics can be numbing and it feels like an industrial slaughterhouse, which of course it was in a lot of ways. But, the whalers were catching wild animals that had, as you know, scientists are telling us these days, they've done incredible research into whale cultures, whale emotions, whale behaviors. That, you know, whales are complex creatures. They pass down a lot of the information necessary for their lives through cultural transmission. That is, they learn it from the other whales around them. It's not embedded genetically, certain behaviors, migration routes, feeding areas, feeding strategies, etc. And so it allows us to understand what was happening with this unprecedented onslaught, which was, you know, not just the kind of devastation of a population, but also the loss of knowledge amongst whale communities. We have pretty clear evidence that whales, even as they've rebounded since the end of industrial whaling in the 80s, have failed to recolonize certain areas, places that they used to go to give birth, to mate, to feed, etc. In part because there was just such a loss of cultural knowledge that was part of this slaughter. You know, you killed so many nursing mothers, for example, right, who then failed to pass on to their offspring certain important facets of what it meant to be a humpback whale. And so that kind of knowledge reverberates today. Sperm whale mothers, for example, seem to be far less adept at keeping their calves alive than they were before whaling. It's surmised that this is, you know, one of those knowledge losses that happened as a result of industrial whaling. So we still see the impacts even as whale numbers are rebounding here in the 21st century.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Now, Red Leviathan is the secret history of Soviet whaling. So getting a little bit into the history of Soviet whaling and also just the Russian history with whaling, I'm always fascinated by a particular culture's relationship with the sea. And you discuss this in the book concerning Russia. So how did Russia historically view the ocean and its resources, and how did this impact their involvement in whaling?
Yeah, you know, Russia, it's such an interesting place to think about humans' relationship to the ocean. You think about Russia, it's this huge land empire, which it is, of course, but it also has one of the longest coastlines in the world. And Russians have been interacting with whales, you know, for a couple of thousand years, of all sorts of different species in the Pacific, in the Arctic, in the Baltic, any ocean, you name it, the Russians had relationships with whales there. And I mean, I think the important thing for Russians was that they basically missed this period of sail whaling. Well, they didn't miss it exactly. They saw themselves as victims in this period. Americans, British dominated that. They had the capital to sustain these long distance whaling expeditions. The Russians didn't. They were, you know, quite poor compared to Western European and America nations. And so what they saw is year after year, Americans coming to Siberian shores, for example, and doing whatever they wanted, even though this was part of what Russia thought of as their own territory. Americans would come in, kill as many whales as they wanted, basically laugh at any kind of Russian attempts to stop them. They trade with indigenous people, Siberians, who in many cases depended on whales for their own sustenance, Alaskans as well. You know, Russia controlled part of Alaska in the 19th century. And, you know, from the Russian perspective, it's just outrageous. These capitalist whalers, Yankee whalers, as they called them, were destroying indigenous livelihoods. The Russians, you know, really actually cared about this. They were destroying whales that Russians would have liked to have made some money off of. Mm-hmm. And so that really helped shape Russia's major entry into the industry. They came with a lot of historical baggage into it. And when Russia finally established its own whaling industry in the 1930s under Stalin, Joseph Stalin, they thought of it not just as a way to industrialize the country, that was part of it, but as a way to kind of rectify this historical wrong, that their whaling industry was, you know, Russia getting its share and finally able to sort of defend its own oceans against Americans, British, and increasingly the Norwegians as well.
Now, you get into the mystery of whales bit as well. I was taken by what you shared about the mystery of baleen whales, including a 10th century Russian poem that concluded that these whales fed on, quote, heavenly fragrances. Mm-hmm. What are we to make of that?
Yeah, whales are pretty mysterious creatures. they were for humans. Well, they still are in a lot of ways. You know, they spend 99% of their life underwater. Humans really only got to know them when they were washed up on shore or once they'd been harpooned. And so that, you know, whales lent themselves to a lot of mystery. And you know, one of the interesting things that I found researching this book is, you know, the really important work that the Soviet Union did, especially as scientists, and kind of unraveling some of these mysteries. You know, you read this poem. This was a great indication of the really almost total ignorance of whales that humans had in the 10th century, but really up until the 20th century in a lot of ways. And, you know, the Soviets, they killed more whales than any country did after the Second World War. They also studied whales in greater depth than any other country did. Their scientists were on the whale ships, you know, digging through whale carcasses, watching whales as they were being hunted, using captive dolphins for study. You know, the Soviet Union, as much as any country, really advanced our knowledge of what whales were. No one was talking about them feeding on heavenly mists by the late 20th century. The Soviets were talking about them nearly going extinct, and they were some of the first to understand how deep the crisis was as well.
Yeah, so in this you're getting into what you refer to in the book as the challenging contradictions that you encounter, and sometimes you're encountering in interviews with Russian whalers and scientists. Right. Can you speak to this a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I came in, I wrote this book because it was horrified and shocked by a lot of things I've just been talking about, the numbers of whales killed, the pain that whales felt. But, you know, to try to understand this and the role specifically that the Russia and the Soviet Union played, of course, I went out and I talked to people who had been on board these whale ships. I went to Ukraine and I went to Moscow and Kaliningrad and other places and talked to people who had been part of this. And it was hard not to like them, frankly. You know, they're people who not only didn't think at the time that what they were doing was wrong, many of them, some of them did. I should make that clear that, you know, some people were really disturbed by the whaling that they were doing. Many were not. And, you know, frankly, most people around the world didn't really care that whales were being killed for most of the time period. But, you know, not only that, but also that they were, you know, they were also really deeply interested in whales, you know, like myself, really fascinated by these creatures. And, you know, when I talked to them, I talked to whale scientists, you know, they wanted to talk. They were so they wanted to relive their experiences with whales. They expressed sympathy for these creatures, fascination for them. You know, I met some of really the greatest whale scientists probably of the 20th century, people who are still who still really care about whales, who tried to blow the whistle in the Soviet Union about some of the illegal whaling that was taking place. And some of them turned out to be, you know, as you said, challenging contradictions. You know, one of the whale scientists that I really relied on for a lot of the information for this book is living in Odessa in Ukraine now. And, you know, has been emailing me, telling me he can't wait for Russia to come free Ukraine from the Nazis. You know, he's a deep Russian patriot who really regrets the demise of the Soviet Union as well. You know, people who not easy to pigeonhole them into easy dichotomies that we often fall into when looking at Russia.
So we touched a little bit already on the history of Russian whaling and their relationship with the resources of the sea prior to the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But then what other reasons are pushing the Soviet Union then to pursue industrial whaling so strongly during a time when other countries are dropping out of the practice?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the crazy thing about this. And it really came through heartbreaking details. I was reading scientists' reports. You know, the Soviet Union really expanded their whaling presence in the late 1950s and early 1960s, just at a time, as you say, Rob, when the Norwegians were starting to drop out, the British were starting to drop out, the Dutch were starting to drop out, the U.S. wasn't whaling anymore. Everyone saw the writing on the wall. Look, the large, profitable whales, we've wiped them out. You know, they're gone. It's not going to pay. And, you know, the Soviet Union, they had a real belief in the power of science. You know, this was a society that was had thrown off God, thrown off religion. It was going to rely on the expertise of people who weren't subject to those kinds of superstitions. You know, they were going to integrate all kind of economic planning with experts. So they had a real belief that they were actually going to be really more responsible environmentally than other countries. So it was just bizarre to read. You know, that they, when the Soviet Union under Nikita Khrushchev was thinking about building, they thought about building 9 new factories, floating factories in the 1950s, which was, you know, was going to make them the biggest whaling country on Earth. And they asked their scientists, is this a good idea? Every scientist said no. They said, look, the oceans are in crisis. And they really were. In the 1950s, it's easy to forget just how we had exploited whale and fish stocks at that time, really recklessly. And Soviet scientists understood this perfectly. They were seeing it happen on board to a man, and they were all men at that time. They advised the Soviet economic planners, like, don't do this. This is crazy. And what did they do? They said, okay, instead of 9, we'll build 7. They built 7 new factory fleets, which dwarfed everyone except the Japanese at a time, as I said, when people were getting out of this industry, just defied logic. And it led to predictable disaster. You know, the Soviets, having built these huge fleets, found that there weren't whales to catch. So they started catching the last of the whales that were prohibited. You know, and they really, you know, the special contribution that the Soviets made was catching those last few whales of the species that really didn't make any economic sense to catch. For the Soviets, though, they had the capacity. They did it. They wiped out almost the last of the humpback whales in the southern hemisphere, the last of the southern right whales. So, it's hard to read that stuff, and it really feels like a kind of a tragic failure of the Soviet belief that science would really make them able to operate more effectively in the world. You know, it could have worked. You know, the scientists told them the right thing, and they ended up ignoring the advice. Really, you know, to the great tragedy of the whales around the world.
But they did end up sending scientists out on these ships as well.
Oh yeah. Right? Oh, the Soviet Union had the largest net of whale scientists really in the world, and said they, you know, they understood probably better than any country in the world what, you know, exactly how deep the crisis was with the world's whales. That's the difficult contradiction here.
So there were international quotas at the time, though, right? How did this play into Soviet whaling activity at the time?
Yeah, right, Rob. So, you know, the Soviet Union was one of the original signatories to the International Whaling Convention that established the International Whaling Commission in 1946. And they'd agreed to abide by quotas, which at first were kind of laughably generous. They wanted to make sure that whalers were still profitable, but became increasingly restrictive over the years. And especially in the 1960s, they had some real teeth in them, and the Soviet Union pretended to abide by those quotas. They would come back, and you know, every year, whaling nations would have to report how many whales they'd killed at the meeting of the IWC. And the Soviet Union would do this. They'd make their reports, and they started falsifying them in the 1950s, at first overstating the number of whales that they'd killed. In part because they wanted to look like they were bigger whalers than they were, and part because they wanted to establish a precedent for having killed this many. But then after they built these big fleets, they realized, you know, we can't abide by any of this stuff. We're to make any money from this at all, we're going to have to cheat wildly, and they did. And so throughout the late 50s and 60s. They'd come back from the Antarctic and say, we killed 350 humpback whales, and they'd killed 12,000. you know, that kind of just devastating numbers, which flummoxed people around the world. You know, whale scientists in Australia and New Zealand, who are monitoring local populations that migrated down to the Antarctic, starting in 59, they saw that suddenly there were no whales coming back, and they couldn't understand why. Maybe there's some cheating going on, but we'd have to, you know, there'd have to be tens of thousands of missing whales to explain what's happening. No one's cheating like that, but actually the Soviets were. It was an unbelievable crime, really, and was a tragedy, of course, not only for whales, but, you know, for those who were studying and cared about them. One that wasn't unraveled until the 1990s, you know, about 30, 40 years later. And it was thanks to those same Soviet scientists who were really upset by this, and they kept their own figures. They kept the real numbers, in part because they hated to see their science messed up by the fake numbers, and in part because they really cared about the future of whale stocks. And thanks to them, we actually know the extent of what was going on.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now, could you take us to a pivotal point in the international reaction to Soviet whaling, the one that you touch on several different times in the book, and that's the Greenpeace protest in 1975?
Yeah, you know, Greenpeace, people are probably familiar with the organization. It's still around, of course, an important environmentalist organization. But they really got their start as an anti-whaling group. They tried some anti-nuclear actions that were only mildly successful in the early 70s, but in 1975, they hit on this strategy of going out to the open ocean and locating whaling fleets and coming between them and their prey, trying to stop them from killing whales. And of course, most importantly, photographing this all, video recording it, and letting the world know, letting the world see just how brutal industrial whaling was, you know, just how awful it was to see these whales being killed. And so it's something Greenpeace called mind bomb, crafting an image that would be so powerful that it would immediately sway global opinion. And they were pretty successful with this. This was a sort of groundbreaking moment in the history of global environmentalism. And it was the Soviets that they decided to target. It was one Soviet ship out of the Russian Siberian port of Vladivostok that they located in June 1975, and was a ship that had just been warned by Soviet authorities and especially Soviet scientists not to take undersized sperm whales. Soviets were really nervous about bad publicity. That was caught red-handed by Greenpeace in this moment, taking sperm whales just off the coast of California that were really small, infants, really, young sperm whales, maybe not infants. And this was, you know, for the Soviets as well, one of the turning points. You know, they, the negative press that they got was really pretty pretty devastating for them. They didn't end whaling right away, but one could point to the Greenpeace confrontations. It's really the beginning of the end for Soviet and industrial whaling as a whole.
Now, how much of that came through to the Russian people at that time, or were they more or less cut off from any mm-hmm. of this in the media?
Yeah, the Soviet Union did its best to hide the confrontation from the Soviet people, but they had access to Western media, Western radio reports, television. They could get some of that. And, you know, one of the things that was I found really interesting in the book was to trace Russian popular opinion around whaling. And it was really changing as well by the 1970s. You know, I give Greenpeace a ton of credit for saving the last of the whales, but there it's not the whole story, the whole story really does connect to some of these same Soviet scientists who, by the 1970s, were publishing a lot of their research in for domestic consumption. Soviet people loved to read about the ocean; they were totally intrigued by it, and they loved to read these popular scientific accounts, and what they were reading was really changing by the 70s. Soviet scientists were, in some ways, kind of similarly to the West, kind of rethinking what whales were. And a lot of the popular publications at the time were talking about whales as humans' best friend. You know, they're gentle creatures. They're useful. They're, you know, dolphins are really loyal to humans, like dogs. Like this is one of the things that Soviet scientists were saying and people were reading about. Some of the Soviet Union's indigenous authors, people from Chukotka, a guy by the name of Yuri Rithiu in particular, was writing novels that really talked about whales from an indigenous perspective as sentient, intelligent creatures. And so Soviet people really gaining this really different view of whales, and it led them to question their own industry, even aside from what Greenpeace was doing. And it comes through quite clearly. They wrote letters to members of the Bolshevik Party, the Communist Party, demanding, for example, that the dolphin hunt be ended, which the Soviet Union did end it in 1966. You know, well before the United States ended marine mammal hunting in 1972, and then increasingly letters to the newspapers, you know, saying, "Hey, look, are we really adhering to the IWC conventions? Are we going to end whaling? What's going on here?" Putting a lot of pressure on the Soviet Union to end its whaling, and that's a big part of the. That has to be part of the explanation for why the Soviet Union ultimately agreed in 1987 to stop industrial whaling. It's a combination of Western environmentalists and some pressure from Russian people at home too.
And did the economic aspects of it play into it at all, or was the whaling industry kind of in the Soviet Union kind of insulated from like market forces?
Yeah, it did play a role. You know, Soviet whaling, it's unclear if they ever made any money off of it. I don't know, a tragedy in some way. If they'd really cared about profits, they never would have built those huge fleets in the 60s. But the Soviet Union was entering into an economic crisis by the 70s. And so these industries like the whaling industry, which were lavishly financed, people make great salaries in whaling, they begin to seem like more of a problem as the Soviet economy as a whole was slowing. And then by the early 80s, really lurching into a crisis. And so the economics did play a role. Yeah. So it was, you know, the Soviets, like the Japanese by the early 80s, were catching really small whales in comparison to the earlier catches, minke whales mostly, and some sperm whales. Minkes are, you know, 20, 30 foot whale, and that's a lot less whale product than you got from a 80 to 100 foot blue whale back in the 1950s. So that was a part of, and they were trying to economize on fuel, and it definitely played a role in getting rid of the Soviet whaling industry. But it had a long history of operating without much attention to profits or losses. It is part of the explanation, but it's definitely not the whole explanation.
So why are Soviets barely a part of the history of whaling, as you discuss in the book, despite playing such a, you know, obviously significant role in it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, part of it is because Soviets were pretty secretive about what they were doing. Part of it is this period of industrial whaling. I don't think people really like to think back on it that much. It was a grisly history. It was a depressing history. There's no question about it. But I think, you know, maybe most of all, the Soviet Union, despite producing this really top-notch research, despite killing so many whales, their scientists weren't allowed to travel around the world, share their research, at least not until the late 70s and early 80s. And so a lot of what they were doing just the world didn't know about, for better or for worse. And you know, that's part of what I wanted to do with this book, was to bring that back into global attention and, you know, account, you know, for the destruction that the Soviet Union wreaked on our oceans. And, you know, I should mention that, look, it's not like just like they were doing this, you know, in some faraway corner of the earth. One of the things that struck me was, you know, when I went to the ocean as a kid in the North Pacific on the coast of California and Oregon, you know, the lack of whales there, well, this was part of the Soviet Union's legacy. They were killing whales just offshore, as were the Japanese, you know, as had American whaling stations as well. But the Soviet Union was impacting my own history here. So I thought it was really important to understand how and why it had done this on a, you know, for the globe, not just for those interested in Russia, but also to give, you know, to give the Soviets their due, especially in the way that they advanced our knowledge of whales. They made really important contributions. We wouldn't understand whales the way we do without the work of their scientists, who did, you know, really incredible stuff. Not just in understanding whale behavior, which was their main focus, but also in keeping the records that we have today of exactly how many whales were killed in the 20th century as well.
Yeah, I want to stress to our readers that even though the subject matter is grim in many cases, like the book is not just one endless horror show. There's there's so much fascinating content about the people involved, the cultures involved, and the science of whales. So I want to stress that to everyone, and also you do specifically mention, you know, that there is light in an otherwise dark tale, mm-hmm. right?
I appreciate that, Rob. Yeah, so you know the book does chronicle a lot of whales being killed. Yeah, this is fundamentally kind of I term one chapter the whale genocide. This is the story of a number of species of creatures which had really flourished on this planet for a long time, carved out a really successful niche for themselves, really suddenly facing extermination. And part of the book is, you know, is chronicling that and trying to understand how whales did survive through this, if barely. But the other part of it, Rob, is exactly as you say, you know, it's a people lived rich lives even as they were, you know, destroying these creatures. And actually, you know, the Soviet whaling industry allows us a kind of look at, you know, some of the really, really messed up, cynical aspects of Soviet life, but also some of the great dreams that people had and some of the ways that they really found meaning in the communist project through their own work, through adventure in the ocean, you know, through real scientific accomplishment. You know, there's I use this story as a way to think about what life was like in the Soviet Union. All of it's really horrible and wonderful aspects, and like any human society, and I had both. And it comes out pretty clearly in the way that people made, you know, some really, really meaningful lives for themselves aboard whale ships, getting to see the world, getting to know these creatures that they were killing in really unsurpassed detail. And also, you know, the real pain that a lot of whalers themselves experienced trying to reconcile all the great, you know, experiences they were having with the fact that they were destroying these families of whales, and they couldn't overlook that fact.
All right, the book is Red Leviathan: The Secret History of Soviet Whaling. It's out now in physical and digital formats. We've been chatting with Ryan Tucker Jones. Ryan, thank you for coming on the show.
Rob, thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks once more to Ryan Tucker Jones for chatting with me about the new book, Red Leviathan, The Secret History of Soviet Whaling. You can get it right now in physical or digital formats. Definitely, if you're interested in anything that we discussed in this episode, definitely pick up a copy of this book. It's a wonderful read. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, our core episodes publish every Tuesday and Thursday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. On Mondays, you'll find our listener mail episodes. On Wednesdays, we tend to put out a short form artifact or monster fact episode. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film. Thanks as always to Seth Nicholas Johnson for producing this episode. And if you want to get in touch with us about anything, this episode, future episodes, past episodes, you can do so by emailing us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.